Maestri's eyes are nothing like the sun. Coral is far more red than her lips red. If snow be white, why then her breasts are dun. If hair be wires, black wires grow on her head. I have seen roses damask red and white, but no such roses see I in her cheeks. And in some perfume is there more delight than in the breath that from my mistress reeks. I love to hear her speak, yet well I know that music have a far more pleasing sound. I grant I never saw a goddess go. My mistress, when she walks, treads on the ground. And yet, by heaven, I think my love as rare as any she belies with false compare.
And that was the wonderful Catherine Tate aggressively reciting My Mistress's Eyes Are Nothing Like the Sun, or Sonnet 130, written by one of the pioneering figures of the English language, William Shakespeare. But before we go any further, hey, hello, how's it going? Welcome to Nerdy and Wordy, a show about a nerd nerding about words. This is episode number 1, and I'm dedicating it to celebrating UNESCO's World Poetry Day. My name is Mary, and I hope you join me as we get nerdy and wordy about poems, language, and writing. We'll be talking all things poetry today from the perspective of a writer who exclusively writes prose. That's right, folks, I don't write poetry at all, but I do appreciate it. We'll get to that bit later. We'll also have more readings of classic poetry from some well-known people. A couple will be read by me just because I couldn't find readings for it. I will link all videos and poems in my post for you to see and follow along. There will also be additional links to some classic examples of poetry to get you started. So, relax, take a seat, have a cuppa. Join me as I delve into nerdy poetry stuff. Now, back to Shakespeare. Among hundreds of his poems, this is one of the most recognizable, next to Shall I Compare Thee to a Summer's Day. This is baby's first poetry, the kind you study in high school English class, including mine. If you want to foray into the world of poems, then Shakespeare is a good gateway. But what is poetry? I'm going to be basic and just recite the Wikipedia definition. I think it succinctly defines what poetry is. According to Wikipedia, poetry, derived from the Greek word poesis, meaning making, is a form of literature that uses aesthetic and often rhythmic qualities of language, such as phonoaesthetics, sound symbolism, and meter, to evoke meanings in addition to or in place of a prosaic ostensible meaning. Oof, long words. A poem is a literary composition written by a poet utilizing this principle. So in prose, we use full sentences, standard writing, and grammatical conventions to tell a story. Poetry utilizes literary devices, imagery, language, and visuals to do the same thing. You can write poems about all subject matter. The sky's the limit, sometimes even beyond. But poetry is not this one whole thing. It's not a genre, just like how animation is not a genre. Treat the concept as you would treat the concept of a novel. There are so many kinds out there. For instance, what we heard in the beginning is called a sonnet, a type of poem. Now, I will be playing another kind for you. Apologies, this one will be recited by me. If you think Shakespeare is ancient, then you'd think this poem is like Dark Ages or something. This poem dates all the way back to ancient Greece. Yeah, ancient Greece. I present to you the first lines of the Iliad by Homer. Enjoy. Rage, goddess, sing the rage of Peleus' son Achilles, murderous, doomed, that cost the Achaeans countless losses, hurling down to the house of death. So many sturdy souls, great fighter souls, but made their bodies carry on, feasts for the dogs and birds, and the will of Zeus was moving towards his end. Begin, Muse, when the two first broke and clashed, Agamemnon, lord of men, and brilliant Achilles. Sounds different, right? So it doesn't look like a duck, it doesn't quack like a duck, but it is a duck. What sort of duck is this? This duck is called epic poetry. An epic poem is a narrative-style poem that thematically revolves around heroism, dealings with the gods and supernatural forces, and how all this shapes the mortal universe. Some poems have a structure, like the sonnet. A sonnet has 14 lines that end in a rhyming couplet, meaning the last two lines must end in a rhyme. An epic poem has no distinguishable form. What structure it does have relies on stylistic conventions, language use, and content. Other epics include Homer's The Odyssey, Virgil's The Aeneid, The Epic of Gilgamesh, and The Divine Comedy by Dante Alighieri. Yes, that one, with the circles of hell. So that's epic poetry. What other poems do we have out there? There are loads out there, let me tell you, but I'll just name a few well-known ones. First, we have the haiku. A haiku is a Japanese poem that has a three-line structure. Each line must adhere to syllabic rules. Line 1 has 5 syllables, line 2 has 7 syllables, and line 3 has 5 syllables. Examples of the haiku are The Old Pond by Matsuo Basho, A World of Dew by Kobayashi Isa, A Poppy Blooms by Katsushika Hokusai. Remember that these are written in Japanese, so the translations often cannot follow the rules. Over time, there has been an emergence of English language haiku, which doesn't necessarily follow the 5-7-5 rule, because English is different from Japanese, but it still follows the philosophy. Here are some examples. In A Station of a Metro by Ezra Pound, The Taste of Rain by Jack Kerouac, and Haiku for You by Sonia Sanchez. Next up, we have limericks. A limerick is a 5-line poem that consists of a single stanza, an AABBA rhyme scheme, and whose subject is a short, pithy tale or description. Let me explain. A stanza is also the same as a verse, one block of lines of text about one or two topics. An AABBA rhyme scheme means that two lines must end in the same sound, the next two lines must end in a different but same sound, and the last line must end in the same sound as the first two lines. Was that confusing? Let me list some examples. There Was a Young Lady of Ride by Edward Lear, A Man Hired by John Smith & Co. by Mark Twain, and The Frequenters of Our Picture Palaces by Norman Douglas. There are many other examples of limericks out there, some more explicit than others, but I do encourage you to have a look. Because of its structure, limericks often sound playful, and that's what the subject matters play with. They use wordplay and twists to keep it fresh, since there's nowhere to hide in limericks. Other topics can be serious as well, like the one written by Norman Douglas, where it focuses on psychology. Last is a villanelle. A villanelle is a 19-line poem consisting of 5 tercets in a quatrain with a highly specified internal rhyme scheme. So just a bit of history on what a villanelle is. A villanelle is a French poem form first written in the 16th century to imitate the rustic Italian villanella dance songs. It wasn't until the 19th century that it became a fixed form poetic structure. So villanelles have a lyrical quality to them and often are song-like. Okay, so let me explain the structure because I know it's a bit more, it's a bit much. So a tercet is a 3-line poem. They can be single stanza or embedded within a larger poem. A quatrain is a 4-line poem. Again, they can be single stanza or embedded. Each tercet has an ABA rhyming scheme, and the final stanza, which is the quatrain, contains an ABAA rhyming scheme. If you're all, what the hell was that? Then here are some examples for you to look at. Mad Girl's Love Song by Sylvia Plath, One Art by Elizabeth Bishop, and Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night by Dylan Thomas. Whew. A lot of rules, right? And there are so many more out there. How do they make it so compelling and beautiful? Well, the subject matter for one. Also, literary devices. Prose utilizes some of them, but not often because prose is already straightforward. Poetry is not built that way, so they must find other ways to convey meaning. Techniques like similes, metaphors, alliteration, onomatopoeia, repetition, personification, and a bunch of other more work together to create poignant imagery that gels the lines and stanzas together into one cohesive idea. Also, another cool thing about poetry is that you can use the space to tell a story. And by space, I mean the page. You want to make a poem about pockets in the shape of a pocket? You go for it. Go wild. Write to your heart's content. No one's gonna stop you. Okay, so up next for our reading is a perfect example of this. This is Jabberwocky by Lewis Carroll, also the author of Alice in Wonderland, recited by the great Christopher Lee. Enjoy.
'Twas brillig, and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe. All mimsy were the borogoves, and the mome raths outgrabe. Beware the Jabberwock, my son, the jaws that bite, the claws that catch. Beware the Jubjub bird, and shun the frumious Bandersnatch. He took his vorpal sword in hand, long time. The manxome foe he sought. So rested he by the tum-tum tree and stood a while in thought. And as in uffish thought he stood, the Jabberwock, with eyes aflame, came whiffling through the tulgey wood and burbled as it came. One, two, and through the vorpal blade went snicker snack. He left it dead, and with its head he went galumphing back. And hast thou slain the Jabberwock? Come to my arms, my beamish boy. O frabjous day, Callooh, Callay, he chortled in his joy. 'Twas Brillig, and the slithy toads did gyre and gimble in the wave. All mimsy were the borogoves, and the mome raths are grey.
That's so vivid, right? The language is ridiculous, but it's believable. It's baby talk that makes sense. Christopher Lee's reading also adds an ominous layer of what is essentially a nonsensical poem. When it comes to poems, sometimes delivery is every bit as important as the poem itself. Speaking of poems, let's talk about World Poetry Day. What? That's a thing? Yes, it is. It is a thing. So, UNESCO, which stands for United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, set this day with the aim to promote world peace and security through international cooperation in education, arts, sciences, and culture. Poetry Day was established in 1999 to support linguistic diversity through poetic expression and increase the opportunity for endangered languages to be heard. Its purpose is to promote reading, writing, publishing, and teaching poetry throughout the world, and to give fresh recognition and impetus to national, regional, and international poetry movements. I got all of that from Wikipedia, by the way. Look, despite not writing poetry, I am grateful for this day. Poetry, I find, has always been niche. It's always been shoved into this stereotypical box of the coffee house poet or the beret, all black wearing, finger-clicking poets in underground clubs. While I struggle to understand it as a prose writer, I know poems are rich. I know they are titillating to the senses. They are packages that keep on giving. You read it once and you think you understand, but you read it again and you discover even more things. They're like literary babushka dolls. So thank you, UNESCO, for this day. If I hadn't discovered it, I wouldn't be here writing about poems, and I don't even write them. Well, with that, we shall move on. Our next poem will be read by Christopher Eccleston, the Ninth Doctor. This is Dulce et Decorum Est. Enjoy.
Bent double, like old beggars under sacks. Knock-kneed, coffin-like hags, we curse through sludge, till on the haunting flares we turned our backs and towards our distant rest began to trudge. Men marched asleep. Many had lost their boots but limped on, bloodshod. All went lame, all blind, drunk with fatigue, deaf even to the hoots of disappointed shells that dropped behind. Gas! Gas! Quick, boys! An ecstasy of fumbling, fitting the clumsy helmets just in time. But someone still was yelling out and stumbling and floundering like a man in fire or lime. Dim through the misty panes and thick green light, as under a green sea, I saw him drowning. In all my dreams, before my helpless sight, he plunges at me, guttering, choking, drowning. If in some smothering dreams you too could pace behind the wagon that we flung him in and watch the white eyes writhing in his face, his hanging face, like a devil sick of sin. If you could hear at every jolt the blood come gargling from the froth-corrupted lungs, obscene as cancer, bitter as the cud of vile, incurable sores on innocent tongues, my friend, you would not tell with such high zest to children, ardent for some desperate glory, the old lie, dulce et decorum est, pro patria mori.
Dulce et decorum est, pro patria mori. How sweet it is to die for one's country. This poem challenges the glorification of war and blind patriotism. In war, no one ever wins. No one. Especially not the soldiers that fight them or the people they leave behind. I first read this poem in HSC High School, and I remember the handout my teacher gave me. It was full of tags and scrawled notes by the end of the class. The poem covered one page. I covered the margins in the next page with notes. So many meanings are packed into a few lines of carefully crafted words and phrases. And you must be precise when you write poetry. And that's what makes writing it so thrilling. I think it's magical in that way. It's like the parable where Jesus divided a few bits of fish and bread among the thousands. I did try my hand at poetry once. It was shown to a friend who was a poetry writer. After reading it, her face was confused, but also doubtful and a touch cringe. Evidently, my poor excuse of a poem was not it. I write prose and narratives exclusively, so poetry is something I struggle to get. And I still do. My mind can't reconcile its need to explain and expand with my desire to craft beautiful, poignant poetry. Sadly, I never tried since then, but I do hope to do so in the future. What do you love about poetry, Mary? Well, thank you for asking. I will tell you. I love it when poems make my heart clench because of the phrasing or the word choice, or when it refers to the little things in life that we often overlook. I think that's beauty, unexplained, but it's still somewhat beautiful. You can do that with prose, of course, but it's often straightforward. You can always explain when something's not clear. Poetry is like life, or breath on a glass, like the 11th Doctor said. You read it and you move on. There's no explanations, no answers. It is what it is. That beautiful line you read is just is, immortalized on the page for other people to marvel at. Did I ramble too much? Well, I am sorry, but you will have to hear my voice just a bit more. I'll play the next poem for you now by Kim So-wol, one of the most beloved Korean poets. This is the translated version of The Stream. Enjoy. For what reason do you act that way, staying on alone by the stream, when green grass shoots push their way up and wavelets ruffle up in the spring wind? I think over your promise that going away is not really going. Each day coming out to sit by the inlet, I keep turning it over my mind. Going away is not really going. Isn't that you're asking me not to forget? What? They have poems in other countries too. I actually first heard of this poem in a K-drama titled The King, the Eternal Monarch, starring Lee Min-ho. Shout out to my fellow K-drama watchers out there. Kim Young-ok, one of the actresses, recited this poem in the show. She is an elderly lady, so when she was reciting it, there was yearning and fragility and wisdom in her voice. She voiced it over a slow-motion emotional scene, and it made me cry. I mean, it was meant to, obviously, but that didn't take away from the beauty of the poem. So, let's talk about this poem a little bit and Kim So-wol. Content warning for mentions of suicide from here on out. The Joseon dynasty in Korea lasted from 1392 to 1910. From that era, two poetic forms became popular, Sijo and Kasa. Like epics, they operate on a thematic structure, some of the themes being nature, grief, and the loneliness of traveling. Kim So-wol was born in 1902. He had a hard life. His mentally ill father was attacked by construction workers and was unable to provide for the family. Kim So-wol's aunt and grandfather supported him. Apparently, his aunt sang folk songs to him, which cultivated his love and talent for poetry. The poems within his last poetry book carried the rhythm and quality that can be found in Korean folk songs, possibly inspired by his aunt. Tragically, the book was born out of the suicide of Oh-sun, Kim So-wol's love. As the times then put more importance on arranged marriages, they were not able to be together. The loss of his love proved too much for Kim So-wol, and unfortunately, he committed suicide at the age of 32. The stream plays on the concept of memory and remembrance. The mention of spring and green grass and splashing water evokes a feeling of a fresh start, of newness and a beginning. Things grow and there is hope. At this stage, love is excited anew, what we call the honeymoon phase. Declarations and promises are made and they seem evergreen. The promise of, even if you go, you won't be gone forever seems comforting, even sweet. If you read the poem, you notice that the second and third stanzas are less and worse than the first. That has meaning, and it's not just there because Kim So-wol wrote it so. That indicates something missing, something being less, something being gone. And when we read the poem, we see that the speaker is now alone. The promise no longer comforts. The water no longer splashes, and there's no more green grass. This is what I mean when I say poetry packs so much. Poetry doesn't read like prose. Everything must be looked at when it comes to poems, down to the stanzas and the page, because that's how they tell their story. And with that, we will move on to another poem. This time it's spoken word poetry. It's one of my favorites, actually. By Shane Khoizan, this is More Often Than Sometimes. Enjoy.
If I knew what I know now then, way back when we first met, I'd point to the sunset and say I drew that for you. Every now and then you can catch it wrinkling in the rain. See, I can talk a good game from the stage, but if you want to gauge a romantic thing said while we're messing up the bed, the best I can give you is, oh my God, we're totally humping. Regardless, there's something beautiful about stating the obvious. All of us do it in those moments when we can't believe it, we have to say it. It's like pinching yourself to make sure you're awake. Take, for example, something as simple as touching someone. We so often say, you're so soft. And the person that touched them last may have said it for the 28th time, but today I'm number 29. And I'm not saying it for her benefit, I'm saying it for mine. Because there's almost 7 billion people in a world, half of which are men, and the number of them is 3.5 billion. Pretty fucking cool that I was number 29. And once upon a time, I was first in line for a girl with freckles and strawberry blonde hair. We loved like an electric chair hooked up to a nuclear power plant and plugged into the sun, and everything we did had never been done. I woke up with a smile the next morning that told the world, I'm number one. I think of her more often than sometimes. And if she ever hears this, I want her to know that our first kiss tasted like pepper. I met her on June 27th. That year, it was Yellow Knife's first day of continual light. Despite the sun not setting that night, we each went home alone. Even though our parents told us to be home before dark, we could have stayed out for weeks. Could have watched the way the sun leaks like liquid over the horizon, casting shadows on all the right places of a bargain bin where love was 75% off and we were collectively 25 cents away from forever. There are times in the north when the sun never sets. And it gets confusing when we ask ourselves questions like, is it too late or too early? More often than sometimes, we didn't care. We loved like two games of solitaire waiting to be played by one another. Her mother once asked me, do you love her? And I told her if there were 1 million teachers breathing down my neck telling me that the answer is no, I would say yes. I guess that was enough for her. Because that girl's father palmed me a condom and wished me a happy birthday. Even now, there's no way to tell. Was that awkward or creepy? We loved like two hitmen hell-bent on assassinating regret. Her orgasm, a wet gremlin multiplying itself into another. Her younger brother knocked on the door asking, what are you guys doing in there? And somewhere amid the awesome and the amazing, we replied in unison, studying. And technically we were. I wrote notes on her skin and flesh-toned permanent ink that would sink and set inside as I tried to underline the important parts of her. Belly button, birthmark, collarbone. Wrote notes explaining that hers felt like silk stretched over stone. I said, you're so soft. She smiled and said, duh. Followed by my belly button is not an erogenous zone. And I said, I hate that word. She said, which one? And I said, erogenous. I told her there's beauty in the obvious. And your belly button, that's where you started. That's where cells divided and grew into you. So let me do what students do best. You can test me later. Right now, let me study. She smiled and said, you're lucky. This is a take-home test, boy. I think of the beauty in the obvious. The way that it forces us to admit how it exists. the way it insists on being pointed out like a bloody nose, or how every time it snows, there's always someone around to say, it's snowing. But the obvious isn't showing off. It's simply reminding us that time passes, and somewhere along the way, we must grow up, not perfect, but up and out. It teaches us something about time, that we're all ticking and talking, walking the fine line between days and weeks, as if each second speaks of years and each month has ears listening to forever but never hearing anything beyond centuries swallowed up by millenniums, as if time was calculated in the sums needed to fill the empty belly of eternity. We so seldom understand each other. But if understanding is neither here nor there and the universe is infinite, understand no matter where we go, we will always be smack dab in the middle of nowhere. All we can do is share some piece of ourselves and hope that it's remembered. Hope that we meant something to someone. My chest is a cannon that I've used to take aim and shoot my heart upon this world. I love the way an uncurled fist becomes a hand again. Because when I take notes, I need it to underline the important parts of you. Happy. Sad. Lovely. Battle cry ballistic like a disaster in lipstick, earthquaking and taking out the monuments over my hollow yesterdays will always have the obvious. It reminds us who and where we are. It lives like a heart shaped like a jar that we hand to others and ask, can you open this for me? We always get the same answer. Not without breaking it. More often than sometimes. I said, go for it.
My teacher gave me this article from the New York Times written by Tish Harrison Warren titled, Why Poetry is So Crucial Right Now. The article claims that nowadays words are ubiquitous. With the power of technology, we have words at the palm of our hands. We have more command with them than ever before. By broadcasting whatever words we want at any time, we risk cheapening them. And I see this all the time. Other people do as well. There are words we're tired of hearing right now at this moment, like coronavirus. Some words, rightfully, lose their power, but others lose the meaning that once gave it authority. Tish says that poetry whispers truths that cannot be confined to rationality or experience. It reclaims the power and grace of words, and that in the face of weaponized words, reminds us to treat them with care. Yes, they can win and fight and argue and hurt, but they can also illuminate and guide, like lanterns. Do you know how beautiful it is to state the obvious? Shane does and lets people know in his spoken word poetry. There is an immensity to something so little, so overlooked, and I find that amazing, but I can't explain why. I love the line about us ticking and talking, walking the fine line between days and weeks, the use of the onomatopoeia, the vivid imagery of how time goes by so fast, and it really does nowadays. It's simple, but it speaks to the human experience. It lights me up in a way I can't put into words. So, I agree with Tish. Shane speaks to the human experience. Kim Sowol does as well with heartbreak and love. So does Wilfred Owen with his true portrayal of war. And even Lewis Carroll with his nonsensical monsters. Tish's poetry class professor reminded her that poetry is the art of paying attention. And it is. The way poems are written engages us and encourages us to pay attention. And not just to the poem itself, but to life. Not that prose doesn't do the same. I'm sorry, I'm dissing prose so much even though I write it. But poetry has that eye-catching quality that invites us to have a closer look. Thanks to my teacher, by the way, for pointing me towards that article. It was an enlightening read. I actually had fun reading it. Okay, so let's move on to our final poem. Yes, I know. It's sad. How can it be the last poem? But alas, all good things must come to an end. This poem was written by Pablo Neruda and recited by Andy Garcia. This is Tonight I Can Write the Saddest Lines. Enjoy.
Tonight I can write the saddest lines. Write, for example, the night is shattered and the blue stars shiver in the distance. The night wind revolves in the sky and sings. Tonight I can write the saddest lines. I loved her, and sometimes she loved me too. Through nights like this one, I held her in my arms. I kissed her again and again under the endless sky. She loved me, and sometimes I loved her too. How could one not have loved her great still eyes? Tonight I can write the saddest lines. To think that I do not have her, to feel that I have lost her, to hear the immense night still more immense without her, and the verse falls to the soul like dew to the pasture. What does it matter that my love could not keep her? The night is shattered and she is not with me. This is all. In the distance, someone is singing. In the distance, my soul is not satisfied that it has lost her. My sight searches for her as though to go to her. My heart looks for her and she is not with me. The same night whitening, the same trees. We of that time are no longer the same. I no longer love her, that's certain. But how I loved her. My voice tried to find the wind to touch her hearing. Another's. She will be another's. Like my kisses before. Her voice, her bright body, her infinite eyes. I no longer love her, that's certain. But maybe I love her. Love is so short, forgetting is so long. Because through nights like this one, I held her in my arms. My soul is not satisfied that it has lost her. Though this be the last pain that she makes me suffer, and these the last verses that I write for her.
Like the stream, this is a translated version. The original was written in Spanish. I would recommend having at least one look at the untranslated versions of any foreign language poem you come across and have a feel of how they use their language to write poetry. Like, yeah, you won't understand a thing, but phonetics and language sometimes are not about the meaning of the words. So, here we are at the end of our podcast. It's sad, I know. But who knows, I might be back for another podcast if you're not sick of me. Thank you for listening. Thanks for sticking with me for so long. I appreciate you. I hope you have a wonderful day. Go out there and read some beautiful poems. Spread the word and keep the magic alive. Remember that all links and sources and more poetry examples are in the post. Please have a look, have a read, and I hope you get to enjoy poetry as much as I do. This is Nerdy and Wordy, and I am Mary, wishing you a very happy World Poetry Day. I shall see you in the next one.